tonight on Arena. Alex Verner on the life and work of Christy Brown, and we hear about the Beatles' Midas man, Brian Epstein. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. A new documentary about the writer and artist Christy Brown aims to expand our knowledge of the man behind My Left Foot. The landmark 1989 film that brought his early story around the globe. Christy was born with cerebral palsy but found, with his mother's encouragement, that he could paint, write and communicate using his left foot. And though Christy found success with this memoir, My Left Foot, and his novel, Down All the Days, he was dedicated to the writing of poetry. This new film, Christy Brown, Self-Portrait, uses his own verse as a lens through which to examine his life and his work. The film is narrated by Aidan Gillen and features poetry reading from Saoirse Ronan. It will be broadcast on RTE One Television at 9:35 on Wednesday of next week. I'm delighted to be joined by the director of Christy Brown's Self-Portrait, Alex Verner. You're very welcome, Alex.
Oh, hello. Well, yeah, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
Now, many people will have seen Jim Sheridan's film My Left Foot with Daniel Day-Lewis in that groundbreaking performance playing Christy. But could you begin by bringing us into the life of Christy and how he learned to live with his huge disability, really?
Well, I mean, My Left Foot, both the original memoir and the film, deals with that subject matter. That was the focus, and that was his quote unquote sort of, you know, overcoming his afflictions and his cerebral palsy. And his mother was instrumental in that, and there were other people who were very helpful outside of the family, like Katrina McGuire, who we mentioned in the documentary, and we were speaking to her daughter. But the purpose of the documentary really is picking up the story after that, because what a lot of people wouldn't realize is that My Left Foot was written in his teens and early 20s and published in his early 20s. So the story comes at it from a kind of what was everything else? What was the Christy, the adult Christy, up until his death? And that's what we tried to explore.
Right. Well, maybe we'll listen to a clip before we continue to fill out Christy's story. Christy's mother, Bridget, is an indomitable spirit and encouragement of her son. They were immortalized in the film My Left Foot. Here, from your documentary, Christy is speaking about her in an interview with the NBC when Down All the Days was published.
Well, my mother was a remarkable person. She had more personality than anyone I ever met.
Did she think that you would become a writer, do you think?
I think she had great faith in me.
She did have faith in
you? Yeah, in every way. She knew what I wanted to do, and she helped me in whatever way she could.
Your whole story of your life is a thrilling documentary on what a person can accomplish, but I think something else, the faith that a parent can have in a child.
Mm-hmm.
That's so important, that they make the child believe.
In himself, yeah.
What did she ever say to you that perhaps helped?
Well, it wasn't what she said, but her actions.
Her actions?
Yeah. Her attitude. Yeah. She just was there.
Archive footage there of the late Christy Brown talking on NBC, and that features on Christy Brown's Self-Portrait, and we're talking to its director, Alex Verner. Alex, how did the documentary then come about? How did you come to Christy's work?
Well, we'd worked with RTE Arts on some other stories of interest, not least Jack Yates, and then one called Untamable about the Irish bogs that connected to Seamus Heaney's poetry, his bog poems. And then we'd been ambitious, and I think the films went well, and it was what was next. but I knew what was next in my mind, at least. And it was Christy's story. But what Christy to me wasn't, I think, what it was to most other people, because I grew up, you know, my dad's bookshelf, there was always a copy of Come Softly to My Wake, which is, you know, a volume of verse, a poetry book. And it was always there. My dad was really fond of it. And by proxy, I sort of became fond of it too. And it's just a really powerful, raw, you know, collection of poems. And to me, Christy was a poet. I thought that was understood. And then when we were talking to RT about it, who were very supportive and interested in the idea because it hadn't been done, surprisingly, it soon transpires when you do the initial research that Christy's not really seen as a poet, and he's more seen as a painter and of course, a novelist and an author. And I found that strange. And I for me, I connected so much with the poetry that sort of became the objective. One was to figure out what people's relationship were with Christy. What did they know of him? And what did we have to do to figure out to renew people's interests and tell a new story of him, the story of him after the memoir, like we said, the young memoir, My Left Foot.
Yes, because you talk about him as a person who wrote a memoir and also as a novelist. And then you'd also talk to other artists about his artwork. But through the use of Saoirse Ronan reading his poetry, you really spotlight it, the poetry.
Yeah, and thanks for noticing that. Saoirse obviously does these sort of breathtaking readings of them and really channels something. And I suppose you could expect that of her. She's so talented, but it's also so honest. What she gets in touch with is so honest. And also, like you brought up before, his relationship with his mother, which is obviously profound. And one of his poems for my mother is incredibly sad and heartbreaking. And it's very, you know, there's something common to everyone in it. You know, most people who've been lucky enough to have a relationship with their mother. And when you start to feel how real his poems are, you kind of wonder how they could be criticized, how they could be seen as sort of over the top or too raw or, too whatever. And, you know, not all that flattering critique when you're sort of comparing it to the big guys like a Yeats or whatever.
Yes, but I think Michael Hartnett said that they were too personal.
That's right. That's sort of, in some ways, I think, paraphrased. But yeah, he was saying that they didn't really offer some perspective on the world. They were introspective. They were sort of his existence. And great poetry is meant to be something that, expands on your sort of vision on the world and your vision on the truth within the world. But Christie's was much more close to him. And the kind of punchline here is that, you know, why is the film called Christy Brown Self-Portrait? And it is an exploration of his self-portrait, but it's not the paintings. It's in his poems. Like, the real most honest picture of him is in his poetry. And that's once you understand that his poems can be seen that way and what he was doing with them and why they're so, you know, narrow or so close or personal, then they change and they become something that really matters.
Well, let's hear. This is a shortened version of that poem you mentioned, For My Mother, and his mother was, of course, Bridget. And first we'll hear Saoirse Ronan read it, and then Christy's younger sister, Anne, who you talked to and who started to read the poem for you. She picks up the refrain of the poem and reads the beautiful concluding three lines.
For my mother. Only in your dying lady could I offer you a poem. So uncommonly quiet you lay in our grieving midst, your flock of bereaved wild geese pinioned by the pomp and paraphernalia of death. For once upon a rare time, wordless, beyond the raw, useless grief of your 9 fine sons. The quiet weeping of your 4 mantled daughters, gathered in desperate amity around your calm requiem hour. And almost I saw you smile in happy disbelief from the better side of the grave. Only in your dying lady could I offer you a poem.
I do not grieve for you in your little square plot of indiscriminate clay, for now shall you truly dance, O great heart, the best of all my songs. The dust be merciful upon your holy bones. That's it. Isn't it wonderful? It's a long time since I've read that. And see what he has here for Anne, for helping me to keep the ship afloat. He has that printed on the book.
There you have Christie's sister Anne, his younger sister Anne, finishing that. And you heard Saoirse Ronan reading For My Mother, a poem by Christie Brown. And that features in Christie Brown's self-portrait. And I'm talking to Alex Verner. Alex, how did you get the family involved? You have Anne, his sister, and also Anne's husband, Willie Jones.
Well, yeah, it's just about starting to build a network of relationships within the Christie Brown remus. And I work with my brother, Joel, and he was very good at this. So the first person we sort of managed to track down was Cleena, who was the daughter of Katrina Maguire. And she was, because Katrina and Christie's relationship was so large and profound, she'd known the Browns since she was a kid, and she'd known Christie too. And Cleena still has connections with the Brown family, and that of course is Anne and Willie. And she introduced us through Joel, and we eventually made contact. And it wasn't the kind of foregone conclusion. They were naturally curious about what we wanted to do, and once they realized this is how it felt anyway, but once they realized it wasn't trying to redo things that had been done but exploring his poetry, that seemed to be a bit of a win for them, because as a family, I think they shared that view. They knew that the poetry was really important to Christie, a way of expressing himself that was very unique. And so that allowed them to sort of let down their guard with us a bit and be very generous with their time and honesty. And that's why, you know, that reading from Anne, which he did spontaneously on the day, it's just gorgeous. And so, as I say, honest. And, you know, it's just amazing that that's her sister, his sister, there with us, reading that poem that's so intimate and about his mother and, you know, about their family. And I think it carries well on the screen as a result. It's not contrived. It was just one of those, you know, great moments that we're lucky to capture.
He was a great correspondent and wrote, you talked about his relationship with Katrina Maguire, which was very much letter-based. And then he had many romantic relationships through writing letters. People would have read his books and contacted him.
That's right. I mean, the prevailing, and I mean, there should be no surprise with this, you know, the prevailing thing that people often say who knew him and remember him was just how much sort of X factor he had in the mm-hmm. room. He was so alive, and these eyes, these blue eyes that kind of shot through you. And he was funny. He could make people laugh. And of course, then you're attractive. As soon as you can make someone laugh, you know, it's very, very attractive, and he was that, and yeah, he did. He had a very complicated love life, as a lot of people are fortunate to have, and he was no different. There is, he had a complicated love life, and it was complicated to him, and he, you know, again, expressed often in his poetry and his pictures, he found marriage through that. He eventually married Mary Carr, who's, of course, you know, depicted very well in the film, and featured in his memoir, but she had a very big impact in his life and a complicated one.
Yes, because you tease it out with the Sheridan brothers, Peter and Jim, and obviously they said that they were making a film. So in many ways, My Left Foot, the film, had a kind of Hollywood ending. But the relationship between Christy and Mary was a very troubled one, especially, I think, when they left Ireland.
That's right. I mean, this is where his letters really, I knew, like, on seeing them. And then the National Library holds a lot of them, as do the little museum. And when you see them and see some of the words on the page, some of the disclosures, they really sort of act as a kind of diary, more so than a, you know, direct letters to someone. You can actually read them as disclosures to oneself, you know, between him and him. And it's a lot of it is about his foibles, and that a lot of that was alcoholism. He drank a lot. He knew he was an alcoholic. He said so in his letters. And he struggled to deal with it. And Mary was too, apparently, according to the letters. And the way I put it, you know, it's strongly worded, but they were in a kind of, you know, a booze-fueled death spiral together. And and so it was for him anyway. Yeah, and it's sad, and it's probably of the time a bit as well, but that didn't go well for them. It wasn't productive, and it led to a very sad end.
Very sad end, and very sad when you think of the joy that My Left Foot, the film, would have given people.
Yeah, and of course, Down All the Days is other standout, you know, novel. Yeah, it's and again, it's something that people, I don't think, would realize or know that, you know, he didn't quite like the poem we start with in the film, which goes as far as to say, you know, for nothing else, you know, he wanted to die under Irish skies, but he didn't. He died in Somerset, England, and we actually, even in part of our research, we saw the coroner's report, and we mentioned that at the end, you know, that those sort of stark, strange words, death by misadventure, which was kind of a, you know, this kind of haunting summary of how you die that way through alcoholism and that.
Well, there's so much in the film, and a huge exploration of how he felt about his own disability. But there's also a very interesting contribution by Christy's brother-in-law, Willie Jones, when he talks about Christy and the relationship with the church. We'll just play this clip. There's a language warning here because I think he's quoting Christy.
As they say, I could tell an awful lot of stories, but some of them wouldn't be fit for camera.
No, because he cursed a lot, Christy did. And I don't blame him.
Every month, a mother used to have the priest coming from the church, communion. And so the Saturday after the mother died, Christy was just in a state, just having a drink, wouldn't get out of bed. Parish priest, he came up to the door, I opened the door and he said, I've come to see Christy. So I hold on a minute, and I went out to Christy, and I said, Christy, the priest is here to give you communion. I said, tell him to fuck off. That's the very words he said. I said, I went out to the priest, I'm sorry, he doesn't want to see you. He's not able. And he said, tell me what he said. So he told me to tell you to fuck off. So not as polite as that, but I'm telling you. That was the end. I was excommunicated from the church.
Excommunicated from the Catholic Church. There, Willie Jones, Christy Brown's brother-in-law, telling us that. In terms of his poetry now, Alex, do you think that people are, you know, assess it in a new light, or do you think it's still done through that criticism that was there, that it was almost too raw?
It's a great question, and it'll always be down to the individual who picks it up and reads it. If the film does anything at all, you know, I hope people would get a perspective on it and why the poetry is like it is. And I don't think it needs too many caveats, personally. I love it. I think it's incredible for what it is. But I think it's always down to who connects to it and why, and what filter they put in front of it based on what they know about the artist. And this is a complicated facet of all art. And, you know, the film touches into this as well.
Well, Alex Verner, thank you so much for talking to us. People will be able to hear the poetry of Christy Brown on Christy Brown Self-Portrait. And that's going to be broadcast on Wednesday of next week, November the 6th, on RT1 television at 9:35. Brian Epstein was a visionary manager who took a chance on a local band from Liverpool and helped them become one of the most influential groups in music history, the Beatles. Known for his unrelenting dedication, Epstein's life was marked by both extraordinary success and private struggles. He managed not only the Fab Four, but an array of talent, all while grappling with societal pressure that forced parts of his identity into the shadows. In a new film, Midas Man, directed by Joe Stevenson, it brings Epstein's story to life with a balance of celebration and sensitivity. The film peels back the curtain on the swinging 60s, revealing the triumphs, heartbreak and secrets of the man who changed the face of music. I'm delighted to be joined by Joe. Joe, to bring us into the life of Brian Epstein, he began life as the son of a furniture dealer from the Jewish community in Liverpool. What were his first steps into the music business?
Well, into the music business, he was trying to make decisions. He was trying to find his place in the world. He wanted to do many things. And in fact, he did even study at Barda as an actor, and then had to come home when he was arrested for lewd behaviour. Again, part of the issues, obviously, of homosexual acts being illegal. And so when he came back, he tried a couple of things. But the key thing that walked him into the industry was that there was a record section of his dad's store, which was not big at all. It was just a handful of records. And he asked his father to let him have that and expand on that. And in doing so, he actually then took over a huge space and actually ended up with his own store, NEMS, which became one of the biggest record stores in the North.
In Midas Man, Jacob Fortune Lloyd plays Brian Epstein, and he is quite apart from his family as well as the Beatles when he meets them. And I guess it's that RADA education. He speaks beautifully and not with any kind of Scouser accent.
Yeah, although to be fair, that I think it is going to be part of the acting training, I suppose, that he went through. But also, it mattered very much, I think, to his family that they spoke properly. It was again a part of being seeking acceptance and seeking respect in the community, which I think, you know, at that time was common in all areas. It wasn't particularly just a Liverpool thing. So he definitely they would correct him if he came back from a school with any Scouse accent.
So the boast in his record shop is that he can get any record from anywhere. And that leads him to visit the cavern to listen to this band called the Beatles. Can you describe how you created that scene of Epstein going to the cavern and what he finds there? It's in the middle of the day, isn't it? It's not even at nighttime.
No. The cavern had these wonderful lunchtime sets, and so people would go and take their sandwiches and have a cup of tea and watch local bands play. And it's at one of those lunchtime sets that Brian goes down. We ended up having to recreate the entire cavern, because the cavern that's there now isn't actually the original. It's very, very similar, and they've done a very good job. But we wanted it to be 100% accurate and go back to the original layout and the original structure. So had to completely rebuild that as a set, including the tuck shop where people get their sandwich and having steps going down, etc. So we managed to recreate it pretty well. We had a few people coming to visit the set who had been to the original cavern, who commented that it was pretty much exactly right, apart from the smell. which we had no need to recreate. It was always a bit damp and it was always a bit smelly.
And that wonderful raw performance that the Beatles gave in that first introduction to Epstein, it was that created from your imagination or from talking to people?
Well, there's a lot of accounts of what the Beatles were like at that time. So we had a lot of references. There is also footage that it was shot a little bit later, but it is footage of them performing in the cavern early on. And the song that they perform is the song that we have our Beatles perform in that scene. And so we had various different references to look at and various people who were there at the time who would be able to tell us exactly how it felt and what they were like. We constantly went back and forth with a lot of people who knew Brian and knew the Beatles and were there then in those early days, so that we could always make sure that we had an eye on the authenticity of the entire thing.
So let's listen to a clip now. This is after he sees them in the cavern and knows there's something about this band. So he brings them into his office and tells them he wants to be their manager.
You're all clearly very talented, and your energy is palpable.
My gran takes pills for that.
And your humour is endearing.
Curtis Neddy has spotted us.
But your stage presentation, it's attractive. But you don't seem to care what you look like.
No complaints from our friends.
Those kids at the cavern.
Easy there. No, you're talking about our future wives.
So what do you want from these scruffy, not terribly aware, yet talented and quite attractive youngsters?
I want to represent you. Be your manager.
What other bands do you manage?
Well, I won't lie. You'll be the first. I sell more records than anyone in the Northwest. Now, I can smell a hit before the vinyl's even dry.
Yeah.
I speak to the record labels every day, and if I say the next big thing, they're going to jump at the chance. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, what's in it for you?
25%.
Is that normal?
Well, that's fair. I'll pay you in cash every week. Look, what I'm trying to say, terribly well, is that I think you're special. What I saw on that stage, I will never forget it. I think you go all the way. And I promise I will look after you.
Jacob Fortune Lloyd as Brian Epstein, Jonah Lees as John Lennon, Blake Richardson as Paul McCartney, Leo Harvey Elledge as George Harrison, and Adam Lawrence as Pete Best. And I'm talking to the director, Joe Stevenson. Joe, the fact that Brian was homosexual and that he was from the Jewish community, did that kind of idea of him being an outsider, did that give him, I don't know, that something special that made him such a risk taker?
Well, definitely. I mean, if you are risking your life or, you know, just to be yourself every day, I think that when it comes to taking risks that he had to make as a manager are probably far less intimidating, which certainly I think probably contributes to a lot of success. But on top of that as well, if you are, if you're gay and it's illegal to be gay, you are going to want to probably work more. It was quite common at the time that men who struggled with this ended up working far more because there wasn't any private life to go home to. And if it was, it was risky and it was dangerous. And so putting the extra work in and making that your life was quite a common trait.
Yes, I mean, his work is so important to him. And while his sexuality may not have defined him, but it often really endangered both his career and his life.
Absolutely, yes. And it did. There were lots of moments where he would, whether it be encounters at the docks with men, where they would get caught, or where the men there were there to mug people, and take advantage of this situation, whether it was being arrested in London, which is actually before our film starts, but when he was at RADA, the reason why he came back from RADA was because he was arrested. So it's constantly throughout his life, he's at risk. And we see a relationship that, again, he was taken advantage of, and the precarious situation that he's in. You can't just go to the police about things. So it was a constant struggle, something hanging over him all his entire life.
Well, let's listen to a clip where we have Brian. He's coming home to find his parents, Queenie, played by Emily Watson, and Harry, played by Eddie Marsan, waiting up for him after they had a call from a man who plans to blackmail their son, Brian.
You're not paying him off. We're going to the police station in the morning.
We can't.
Let them handle it.
If we go to the police, I'll get charged. I could go to jail.
No, you won't go to jail. We'll tell them you're just not well.
Harry, he is not going anywhere.
It's worth a try. I mean, you can't be happy like this, Brian.
Harry, I have read about this. He is not sick. You just can't change the way that he is.
That's typical of you. Making allowances.
What are you all doing up?
I'll give him money. It won't be much. He'll go away.
The next time. And the time after that. And what will people say?
Is that all you care about, your reputation?
No. Our reputation. Our business. Our family!
You need to be more careful. Less trusting.
It's not just about you.
And what about your boys? And Scylla? If the papers got hold of this, it could destroy them.
We're worried about you, love.
There, that's Emily Watson as Queenie and Harry, his father, played by Eddie Marsan. And of course, Brian Epstein there, played by Jacob Fortune Lloyd. And I'm talking to Joe Stevenson, the director. They're powerful scenes, those family scenes. And Queenie has great sympathy and understanding of her son, whereas the father has understanding, but he's more protective and more societally protective.
Well, he's very much a man of the time. I mean, he was very concerned about what Brian's life would be like if anybody found out, but also about his family's reputation. They did, after all, spend a lot of time building up their family's reputation in the community, whether it be through their shop, the Epstein's store, or, you know, in general, it was the same for a lot of people at that time, but that it was... We couldn't expect more from him, I don't think. He loved his son very much, but he couldn't quite navigate it in the same way that perhaps Queenie could.
The casting of Jacob Fortune Lloyd as Brian Epstein is wonderful casting. How did he prepare for the role? And what did you want from your Brian Epstein in Midas Man?
Jacob did an extraordinary amount of research and listened to a lot of interviews with Brian, so they could obviously try and understand his voice and get used to his way of speaking and the way he was. But reading his own book, Cellarful of Noise, reading biographies that are out there, he dove into it in quite an intense way, as you'd expect from such a talented actor. When it comes to my Brian, what I really wanted to make sure was that the film was... not shying away from those darker parts of his life, but remembering it's always a celebration, and always going back to actually a lot of the accounts that people who knew him always say. And they always say that he was a genuine, loving individual who was, you know, kind and a good soul. And like everybody has their temper problems, and everybody does every now and then make mistakes. But that's the one thing, that's his legacy, is that he cared so much about his clients and he worked so hard for them. And so we wanted to make sure that the Brian that we portrayed, the audience could fall in love with him in the same way that everybody who knew the real Brian fell in love with him.
Yes, because he's in no way like the parasite type of manager. He's deeply protective of the Beatles, and you show scenes where he's almost one of them. And his relationship with Cilla Black, who is also in his stable of talent, that's a really touching relationship.
It is. So it was hugely important, very much. People sort of say that perhaps that was the closest to a soulmate he had. They were very close friends. But he was with the Beatles, but also with Jerry Marsden, with Billy J. Kramer, a whole raft of clients he felt so protective over. And yeah, it's not not what you hear normally about managers. We could probably do with more managers like Brian. He really genuinely cared and put that at the front of everything. And I think he felt responsible for them, and to a degree that would cause him a lot of pain if things weren't going quite right, or if there was a mistake made. He took that to heart a lot, which caused him quite a lot of anguish. But he absolutely was very, very close with all of his clients.
Well, congratulations on your film, Brian Epstein, Midas Man. Joe Stevenson, thank you so much for talking to us. Midas Man is available to watch on Prime Video now. And let's finish with some of the Beatles. I Want to Hold Your Hand. I want to hold your hand. Poet John McAuliffe grew up in Listowel, County Kerry. He moved to the UK in 2002 and now teaches in the Centre for New Writing at the University of Manchester, where he is Professor of Poetry. National Theatre is his new book, one he's been working on since 2021 when he published a volume of his selected poems. This sixth collection touches on his usual concerns: the natural world, the domestic, the turbulent times worldwide we find ourselves in, and other writers, from the Roman poet Horace and the late Martin Amis to our own poets Derek Mahan and Thomas McCarthy. John McAuliffe joins me now on the line from Naples. John, you're very welcome.
Hi, Kate.
Now, the Roman poets Horace and Virgil are touchstones for your own work, and we'll come to them shortly. But tell us what you're doing in Naples. You're researching for an essay you're writing, or that's what you've told your publishers, I'm sure.
It's a lovely time of year to be here, and I do feel like I've looked out my timing for once. But I'm here with a friend who's a classical scholar, and we're actually looking at where Book 6 from the Aeneid takes place around north of Naples, around Lake Averno. I'm writing about Seamus Heaney's Book 6 of the Aeneid translation, which was the book he was working on at the time of his death. So it's a sad project in some ways, but it's a wonderful.
I think John's line may have gone down. John is back. That's the trouble of being in the hot sun of Naples, John. You just, you know, you're overcome by the heat.
It is lovely here. But yes, I'm working on looking at Seamus Heaney's Book 6 of the Aeneid and visiting the sites that are mentioned in that book. The alternative was to spend a week in the Upper Van, a lovely part of the world, and I'll be there as well. But not quite as nice as Naples at this time of year.
No, I won't say you've made the better choice. I'll let other people decide. So your new collection is called National Theatre, and I'm going to ask you to read the title poem. But it's something we all get up to when we are at the theatre, an old bit of gossip, isn't it? Bring us into the poem.
That's right. So it's a poem that's dedicated to my friend Tim Price, who's a Welsh playwright. And it mentions the National Theatre of Wales as well as the Abbey Theatre. But I suppose this poem and an awful lot of poems in the book are about finding an image which really tells a whole story or reveals something. And one of the things, I suppose, over the last number of years has been about the National Theatre. A lot of the interest has been in the drama about the National Theatre as much as what's actually happening on the stage. So here's the poem, National Theatre, for Tim Price. In the film he has been adapting for the stage, we can't stop laughing at the opening scene. Man, woman, child, a family sit at a table in a ski resort's conservatory as what looks like a snow shower develops into what looks like an avalanche, so that the husband, father, main man first says, "It's nothing," as he starts to inch and, taking fright, runs away, saving, he presumes, his skin. And when it isn't an avalanche, but a passing snow shower, must crawl through settling dust to what he abandoned and won't recover from, what looked like an avalanche, disclosing somehow that what looked like a family, what looked, for better or worse, like a marriage, was not that, not exactly. What is the avalanche but this? We are laughing still, his folding under pressure so unfortunately applied until he is true to himself. And my friend is wondering too at how the theatre must devise this snowstorm, which isn't. And I'm thinking of how what people say stirs up storms of hot air, a good life must navigate and sail through to actual rough water. And the conversation turns inland again to what on earth is happening at the Abbey and what in God's name is the story at NTW. And we are talking while the enormous wave of white noise angles our way in the wings from where we can't even see the weak layer it finds in things.
Very nice. That's National Theatre from John McAuliffe's collection of the same name, National Theatre. As I said in the introduction, there are a lot of references to poets long gone and recently gone. And you talk about two writers that mean a lot to you, Derek Mahan and Martin Amis. You knew Martin Amis.
I did, yeah. Martin worked with us at Manchester for 4 or 5 years. So he taught on the MA program, and then he moved to New York after finishing his time with us. And when I was in New York, I'd drop in, and we had a great collegiate friendship over the years. And I was very sad, you know. He'd been ill for the last year of his life, but when he died last May. 2023, but he was in good spirits and working hard as he always did.
Yes, and you talk in the poem about you were in Barcelona and it happened that there was a football match on with lots of Manchester United fans.
Yeah, we had kind of snuck off. You know, we'd booked a midweek break to Barcelona a long time ago, 1999, of course, and we discovered. Having a nice time on the Ramblas, eating our dinner, all of a sudden at 10 o'clock at night, tens of thousands of Manchester United fans descended on us, having had their famous extra time victory over Bayern Munich. And years later, when I was talking to Martin, it turned out, and this is one of the things about him, I suppose, is that he really did get around as a working journalist, and he had been there covering the match, and he had taken his sons along to it as well. Although one of the great things about Martin was that he one of the things that he said is that he kind of enjoyed the exuberance of others. So he wasn't a United fan. And in fact, he claimed to be both an Arsenal fan and a Tottenham Hotspurs fan, which is an unusual combination. But he just kind of, he enjoyed sport and he enjoyed watching people having a good time. And he kind of relished the pleasure principle in life.
Now, I said the other preoccupations you have are nature and wildlife, and bird life is everywhere in this book. You're going to read herons for us. So you might introduce it first and then read it, John.
Sure. So herons is so the poem, I turned 50 while I was writing the book, and there's a sort of a selective cast which comes with that sense, and I suppose also having written the selected poems and that funny sense of reviewing what the books stack up to. And this is a poem which is looking at the life, I suppose, that I lived as a parent very often, and the kind of schedules and deadlines of that life, which as our kids have grown up have changed a little bit. And it's remembering looking at a heron in a river and thinking it was a statue, it was still for so long, and then turning around and finding it gone, and having that sense of things which are there for a long time and then suddenly change and disappear. So here's that poem, it's called The Herons. Rise earlier than anyone. So then if, sing at dawn to the blackbirds, one chord plus reverb. Not that I'm taking the sound apart, what's coming drifts into view. A new draft of who I am, what I want to be. The erratic course the heron cut away from another night. So then if the frosted grass greens under the budding trees, black brims of shadow, a life swims into the fortress of a formal device. I gloried in the forecast whiteout, but today's stir, its spray of pink and late light, the early return of color, crazy tropics, tenders the earth to my planted foot. In the trees, the lights hide in the new leaves. Through a crisscross fence, a heron I mistook for the statue of a heron in the river. So then, if it takes off, shadows retreat. Once I would not look or check. There's dew on the grass and birdsong too. The heron on his stilts. Years of the other lives that make one life.
Lovely. That's The Herons from National Theatre, a collection of poetry by John McAuliffe. John, you talked there about being in Naples and looking at Virgil's work, but there's also a connection with the poet Horace. Where did you first come across him and why does he appeal to you?
Actually, I first came across Horace in the work of Derek Mahon, you know, so I when I picked up Derek Mahon's poems when I was 21, and I can still remember reading a poem that Derek had translated as How to Live. And I just loved the tone of the poem. There's a sort of instructiveness alongside a little tinge of irony. So you're learning almost as you're reading the poem, and you're learning to think alongside Horace. I suppose he started off Horace as a very crisp and brilliant lyric poet, a poet of the lyric cry. But very soon he became a much more meditative writer of these famous odes, which have traveled for 2,000 years through all kinds of translations in different cultures. And I find that meditative, thinky sort of poetry great company. And I suppose that's why Horace has meant so much to me, as I've read him in various translations and tried my hand at translating some of his poems from time to time. And I suppose the link with Mahon has always been very important in terms of thinking about Horace too, in that line of writing a certain kind of poem in Ireland.
Now, we might just have time to hear from Sweet Box. Maybe you'd read that for us, John.
Great. Thanks, Kay. And this is a poem about that flowering hedge which can surprise you very early in the spring, and trusting almost that you can follow the smell, fragrance of it. Sarcococca confusa, or sweet box. Heading back from the flooded footpaths to where I'd parked, between the old vicarage and the green man, we dropped in for lunch and stayed for a drink. I was stopped by a smell I placed first as azalea, then jasmine. But in February, and where, there was by the road just privet, a potted bay, and back a bit a prickly holly out of which, and now we have stepped back and see it, there peeps an inch or two of slimmer stem and clustered buds, tiny, creamy, and this feeling, the fragrance, a sensation, and the discovery of the feeling's source, not so much what we search for as, once we trust it can be ours, what we search with, high and low, every so often knowing its renewable source, the thing itself. I am holding it in front of us now, the stem and flower, ready again to drive off, and for having found it, good to go.
That's lovely. National Theatre is the collection, and John McAuliffe is the poet. National Theatre is published by Gallery Press. John, thank you very much.
Very much, Kay. Good night.
Now, that's it for the programme tonight. It was researched by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Harry Buckless was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. I'm just going to give you the winner of the competition, which is Gerard Murphy in Sligo. He came up with the right answer to the question about who was the hero of The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And it is, of course, Quasimodo. And tonight's show was produced by Sinead Egan, and John Creedon is next.